Good morning. This is Pushing Boundaries, a podcast about pioneering research, breakthrough discoveries, and unconventional ideas. I'm your host, Dr. Thomas R. Verney. My guest today is Dr. Gordana Dodik-Krnković, Professor of Computer Science at Mälardalen University and Professor of Interaction Design, Chalmers University of Technology, both located in Sweden. Her current research is in morphological computing and the connection between computation, information, and cognition by way of interacting agents and different levels of organization from physics to biology. Welcome, Dr. Gordana Dodik-Krnković.
Thank you very much.
May I call you Gordana?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, sure.
Okay, thank you. As I said to you before we started, I was fascinated by your paper in Entropy, which is a bit of a mouthful, Cognition as Morphological / Morphogenetic Embodied Computation in Vivo. You have written that present-day human-centric view of cognition has a variety of problems. A better understanding of cognition is centrally important for future artificial intelligence, robotics, medicine, and related fields. I totally agree, but I would like to hear more from you on that score. What do you mean by cognition? Let's start there.
Okay, I would like to give you a background to this article.
Absolutely.
And this is a part of a special issue of Entropy, which was dedicated to embodied cognition. And that's the third part. We had already two parts with different colleagues collaborating on this topic. And this is a controversy we have in cognitive science. Between people who think that it is quite enough to think cognition in terms of symbol manipulation and language on the level of human language, and the other people who claim that we have to take into account embodiment of human agents and take into account how much of processes that are basis for cognition are done within the body and the environment. So it's embodied, embedded, enacted cognition. It's not hanging in vacuum. It's connected with the world. And we were very much interested to get this discussion between colleagues who believe in different views, to get them together and to get this discussion showing where the positions are and is there a common ground and how we go further. So my idea here in this article was to explicate what are the conventional views of cognition. If we open encyclopedia or Wikipedia or whatever, which is considered the common knowledge, shared knowledge about cognition, we will see that it is about human cognition. It is always on the level of language and symbol manipulation. So I started the article with this definition from Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, written by Paul Tegart. He defines the cognition in the following way. In its weakest form, cognitive science is just the sum of its constituent fields: psychology, artificial intelligence, linguistics, neuroscience, anthropology, and philosophy. Interdisciplinary work becomes much more interesting when there is a theoretical and experimental convergence on conclusions about the nature of the mind. And he elaborates further about our need to understand mind as a process of knowledge generation and cognition. And all those terms are quite vague. And he acknowledges that our present understanding of cognition is connected with number of challenges, questions that we cannot answer from this framework, which is quite narrow and quite rigid. So Thiegard says that we have emotion challenge, how to understand emotion in this framework, then consciousness challenge, the world challenge, how to understand the connection between the agent and the world, and the agent is always a human. The body challenge, how the body interacts with this cognitive process, and the dynamical system challenge, because it is assumed, and it is classical historical assumption, that computation is symbol manipulation. So it is impossible to understand dynamic systems as computational systems because computation is not considered to be a dynamical process. So that many notions that are imminent in this approach are traditional, historical, and they have been changing within their specific fields. But the encyclopedia articles are not following the development in all those fields which are contributing. So the idea of computation has evolved during the years, since 40s or 50s when it all started. And we have a challenge of understanding information, because information is considered as something that is written in a book, in a message, in a newspaper. It's not understood as something that two bacteria can exchange. And then the social challenge, we are thinking typically of an individual human, but not about the distributed cognition in a social setting, both for humans, but also for smaller organisms like cells. So the idea of cognition on the basic level of the smallest living organism, which is the cell, was very difficult for many people still to accept, to understand that everything starts at least on the level of cell. And some people would say that even the parts of the cell have some cognitive properties within this context of cell and within this cognitive process. And so the last was the mathematics challenge. And that was something that already Barry Cooper has been writing about in terms of mathematicians' bias. And Matthias Scholz in the book on computationalism, New Directions, where he says that our classical understanding of both computing and mathematics is not sufficient. Mind is not that kind of symbol manipulation. It's not entirely only the symbol manipulation. It has layers below, which are signal manipulation, data manipulation, the physical computing or physical processes that we can understand as computing, which I term morphological computing. That's the term that is coming from robotics, where people understood, roboticists understood that they can replace part of brain control over the robot with the body shape and the relationships between body parts. So, for example, if you want to have a robot which grasps an object with the hand, you just need a right form of the hand, right proportions of things, right materials in it. So, and if you put an object in a hand, it will automatically close because of the morphology. So it will produce behavior just based on morphology. Mm-hmm. And similar with the passive walker that they have in robotics, they have a robot, very very primitive one, which is going down the slope without any control, just based on the body. which it has arms and legs and everything, and it moves down the slope without any control. So they saw the possibility and the chance to use the body instead of motor control and computers and so on in part of the control of the robot. So those thoughts converge towards an idea that we can study natural systems and try to learn how are they using their bodies in order to solve their problems. And I think you had as a guest Michael Levin.
I was just thinking of that, yes.
Yeah, and he was working a lot about the detailed mechanisms beyond the biological behavior on the level of the cell, how the cell is capable of solving its own problems in its own space and efficiently learn and change its morphology so that it survives and thrives in the environment. So those are very exciting developments, and they have a lot of applications, even practical applications. So for us, it is really very important to understand not only the language on the level of human, but also the language on the level of bacteria. Quorum sensing, it is called, when they talk to each other with chemical molecules exchanged. So there is a lot we can learn from nature.
Now, you said a minute ago that even parts of cells, not just cells, but even some parts like the mitochondria, for example, would some people think may be able of some cognition. Could you just explain that a little bit?
I will tell you, I think we were talking in this article, I mentioned the continuum between evolution of biological systems and evolution of physical system, evolution of the universe, for example. So physics already has mechanisms for changing the structures depending on the past history. So we have galaxies that have history and development and evolution and so on and so forth. So people have been writing about evolution in physics, evolution in chemistry, evolution in biology. So it is a continuum. And when we look at physical systems, they have ability to self-organize. And it is pure physical process based on physical forces between parts. And it is spontaneously developing in nature. So the similar processes go on a chemical level with molecules and so on. They self-organize. Then we have, on the physics level, we have self-assembly, then we have self-organization, and then we have autopoiesis when we come to the level of the cell, which is already a complex system, communicating with the environment through the membrane. And this makes this difference between inside and outside world. And we have this boundary, which is defining an agent, which is a self in relationship to the other that is outside. And it is solving its own problems. So it's a complex system which is made of many parts. And some of those parts...
Stop for a second. What is autopoiesis?
Okay, autopoiesis is a term that Maturana and Varela, Santiago School of Cognitive Science, introduced to describe how a cell is able to self-maintain and continuously support the processes which will retain its essential structures. And it is done with the exchange of energy and the matter with the environment. So it takes the energy from the environment because it is the thermodynamical system far from equilibrium. So in order to support its orderly structures, which are inside the cell, it needs constant flow of energy inside. And then it has rest products which are eliminated through this boundary. So the cell is a very, very complex system which is made of parts, and they are interacting all the time. And some of those parts are thought to be integrated by symbiosis or in some way through the history of the development of cell. From the outside, maybe they were their own autonomous agents in the beginning, but in some processes they became part of the cell. So some of them, I think, I'm not a biologist, but I think mitochondria have their own DNA, or there are some parts in the cell which have their own DNA. They are they have some kind of agency, and they interact and optimize, and you know, they have some sort of agenda. Mm. So I think that's the part that I do not really know. We should ask biologists and people who are really studying this. My point is that whatever we have in the cell, those parts are interacting all the time, and they are interacting with the outside world. Cell has definitely goals. It is trying to optimize its own inner state, endogenous state, which is like a thermostat or whatever. It is trying to keep its parameter within parameters within some ranges, and it is avoiding dangers from the outside world. If it is acid or something in the vicinity, it moves from this dangerous area, and so on. So cells are really trying to do something in the world. They are not passive. They are not just moving at random. They have some goal. And I think Michael Levin explained very nicely that we have some sort of fear of goal-directedness in science. Because when Aristotle was talking about this final goal and things are moving towards this goal, people were criticizing his way of explaining, especially physics, in terms of final goals. So somehow with Galileo, we had this feeling that we will stop to talk about why things are happening. We will just say how, what is happening. So, but now today we have normal scientific explanations for goal directedness. So it is completely possible to understand what is cell doing based on experiences from its past, its learning process, because the cells are able to learn. They are learning. We can see it. And we can also say that its evolutionary past is also sort of learning on the long time scale.
Would you say that cognition can occur without consciousness, or would consciousness enter any sort of being that has cognition automatically? What is the relationship between cognition and consciousness, I guess is the question.
It's a very good question. I have never been studying consciousness, really. My first allergic reaction was when people say the whole of the universe is permeated with consciousness. Then I think you postulate the notion that you want to explain. You just say, okay, it is everywhere, so it is. But what I would like to understand, if we can derive consciousness from processes happening in nature, to understand somehow consciousness in terms of something more primitive, more basic. So I will tell you how I'm thinking about it, even though I am by no means expert on that. But I'm interested in cognition, which means ability of an agent to take, and my perspective is information computation, embodied information and computation. So I have an agent, and it could be living system, it could be a robot or whatever cognitive system. And this cognitive system learns about the world through the signals, through the data coming from the outside. It's always a sort of interchange, interaction between the cognitive agent and the environment. And so what would be cognition on the level of a cell? Is it possible to imagine that cell behaves the way it does without postulating any cognition? Just thinking of it like an automaton. So if we think in terms of physics being automatic process, you cannot make so much choices about what two electrons will do when you collide them or when you... It seems pretty much predefined. It repeats itself always. Chemical processes have a little bit more combinations and possibilities, but also happen quite automatically. So when you see something coming into picture which seems to be meaningful behavior, it's on the level of biology. When you have biological cell, you can clearly distinguish the behavior which is goal-directed, where the cell is solving the problems and increasing probability to survive, and so on and so forth. So I would say that it is possible to understand cognitive behavior of basic organisms like a cell without postulating any consciousness as some extra in the model. And we had a discussion some years ago on this topic, and my claim was that consciousness would be possible first when we have some kind of nervous system, where the agent has a possibility for self-reflection, for self-representation. But you can approach it in many different ways. But at the moment, I think it's not very useful to assume that consciousness is in everything, because it doesn't explain anything. So I'm not pan-psychist. But I'm pan-computationalist, so, and we have a lot of discussions about that. So my framework is computing nature, and I assume that everything that is physics, that moves, that is changing all the time, is computing, and it's computing its next state. So it's not my own idea. It's an old tradition from many generations of physicists thinking about expressing what is happening in natural sciences with help of computation and information. And those are very basic processes. And then you use them to understand how the knowledge is generated in agents, in living agents, and in artificial agents, and so on. So consciousness is really a tricky question when it arrives.
Yeah, I know.
I think you are much better at that part.
No, you're quite right. So what's in store for you next? What are you working on right now?
Right now, I'm planning for a book.
Yes.
It was World Scientific who proposed that I would write a book on morphological computing, or on this computing nature, information, computation, how it relates to living systems, to evolution, in a bigger scale, what I'm talking about in the article.
So where do you see, is it robotics that you're most interested in, or is it cognition of robotics, or both, or what?
I think my first ideas come from an attempt to understand natural sciences up to biology and cognitive science in the same framework. So I started as a physicist, you know. I have education in physics and spent 10 years as a physicist, and then worked 10 years for industry, and then worked 10 years as a computer scientist, and then 10 years as a cognitive scientist. And just recently I started to apply this to design, interaction design, information design, and so on. But the majority of my thinking through those years was based on physics, and I was always trying to go back to physics and understand how other fields relate to basic embodiment. And now in cognitive science, I'm interested in understanding those parts which are self-organization, self-assembly, self-generation, like autopoiesis, and then evolution in new terms. That's a very, very exciting topic, new views of evolution based on cells which possess agency, which show goal-directed behavior.
Where do you think that will take us? What do you see the future for that kind of research?
I think we will learn much more when we understand how those pieces work together. One thing is to understand how organisms work on the level of mechanisms, physical, chemical, biological, cognitive mechanisms, so that we see those levels of organization, how they emerge from each other, and how we get to the level where we understand, when we see a complex behavior in an agent. We can learn from biological agents both how they work, and that can help us to cure illness, to understand the psychological makeup of a human on some level. And then we can use it in artificial life, robotics, artificial intelligence. For example, a study of computation. I mentioned that old cognitive science was thinking in terms of Turing machine, let's say, a symbol processing in the form of Turing machine. However, we have learned that there are many more types of models of computation that could be interesting for modeling of, for example, cognition and intelligence. We would like to have efficient computation, dynamic computation, adaptive, intelligent, cognitive, and everything like that. So Turing machine has no boundaries to resources. It has unlimited resources. And every living organism which is solving their problems have very scarce resources, and they are saving their energy and space and everything. So they are computing in a completely different way. So we would like to learn to compute with small resources. Because we are using more and more computing in everyday life everywhere, and it costs a lot of energy and emits a lot of energy in the environment. We would like to have much better computers, and we hope to learn from nature how to compute more effectively and more intelligent and more cognitive and so on. So that's one thing. Also, information processes, information storage, memory, all those mechanisms that we have in nature, we would like to learn and apply for our own purposes. So one part of the idea to learn from nature is to learn how to better compute, how to better manage information, but also, and that is what other people are doing in medicine and psychology and other fields, to understand better processes that are going on in our bodies and in our brains. So it's both applications and real understanding of what's going on. But what is happening, you know, we are changing the basic definitions. So now cognition, that's not only human cognition on the level of language. Even when we talk about the human, we think about all the cells of the organism, not only nervous cells in the brain and nervous system, but also all the cells which like immune system. It is communicating with the brain constantly, and also all this connection with the rest of the body, you know. So we would like to really understand how all those parts work together and what is happening, and certainly we will know better to help people to cure problems of all kinds. If you understand how all those processes work and how body connects to mind or thinking or psyche, those very complicated terms.
Right. So on a little more personal level, could you tell me who were sort of the three most important influences in your life, people or theories? Particularly people, were there sort of, could you point to three people in your life who in some ways really, really influenced you?
I can tell that my parents were the first people who influenced me considerably, because my mother was natural science, or she was a chemist.
Oh.
And she was a typical, prototypical natural thinker. So for her, all the explanations were somewhere in nature, and nature was the ideal. And my father was economist, and he was looking at the world through the lens of relationships between people and social relationships in social groups and so on. So those were two different poles in my development. I never really decided to be only on the natural sciences part, but I was mostly, during my whole life, a lot of my interest was on natural sciences. But people are also important. I'm interested in ethics. So I'm teaching ethics, and I'm thinking ethics, and I think without ethics, things don't make sense. So we need to have this value system and the ongoing discussion about what we are doing, what we want to solve, what we want to have in the future, and so on. So those are those natural sciences, human poles, two of them. And then I had an uncle who was an engineer, and he was my third very important influence in life. He was in electrical engineering, and at that time, old times, when I was a child, he would get TV sets, old TV sets with the vacuum tubes from our neighbors and other people. They were always having problems with TV sets. They didn't work properly. So he would take a TV set, open it, and tell me how he was reasoning, where the problem must be. So it was the power of logic. Mm-hmm. And he was able, and he was guiding me through his own steps of reasoning, how to pinpoint which of the tubes must be wrong. And I was totally fascinated by his ability to change this tube, and then it works. So that was my fascination for engineering. I still have it with me. It's like a magic engineering when it works at best.
Sure.
But of course, yeah.
You mentioned ethics.
Yeah.
So in this work that you are doing with computations and building better and more clever robotics, what sort of ethical issues have come up for you?
There is a lot of ethics connected, especially with AI. And that's a very, very interesting development. So I remember when I started teaching ethics around 2000, I introduced this course at the university, and people were asking me, why should we need this course? We have so many other important things to teach students, like computing heat, computing in this way and that way. And I was telling that, trying to argue that this makes perfect sense, because computing is becoming so pervasive, so central in our lives. It is changing everything. And it has shown with time that it really affects us so much as civilization and as individuals, using internet, using mobile phones, texting. Everything changes our relationships and our understanding of ourselves and communication and everything. So I think it was really meaningful to start discussing with classes of computer scientists, or future computer scientists, what is the role of science, what should we do, what are the problems, where do we see challenges, and so on. And with AI becoming stronger and stronger, many people started to understand how powerful this technology is. And other people don't really know what is in those boxes that our students are building. So it's really important that they know and that they think about it in the first step. So that was my motivation to start and continue with teaching ethics to computer scientists in generations. And I see that many of my students from before, now professors at the university, are using this thinking about, they are AI professionals thinking about ethical aspects of their work. And I think it's really very, very good. It makes very good sense. For example, we have now a huge discussion about ChatGPT. How to manage and how to relate to ChatGPT, which generates perfectly reasonable text. Yes. It sounds very reasonable and could be wrong as well.
Yeah. By the way, you mentioned Michael Levin. He has used that app to do some incredible art.
Oh.
And he has got some beautiful, beautiful pictures, which are like right out of DALL-E, or, you know, all kinds of, like, all you have to do is talk into that app and tell them what you want it to do, right? And it will create that, whether it's art or, as you mentioned, essays or anything like that. So there are some huge ethical problems involved in that. Huge.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's very, very good and interesting that everybody is talking about it. We had already workshops at the university where the teachers were discussing and telling how to relate to this, because we have got from students, one student sent a mail and said, this mail is generated by ChatGPT, and by the way, my essay is also generated by, or in some way, and with, yeah.
So are you still teaching?
Yes.
What is it that you enjoy about teaching?
Oh, it. For example, in those courses in ethics, we have a lot of discussions and we work together. It's like a workshop. I had one lecture last year, about my idea of teaching is like Leonardo da Vinci's workshop with his colleagues, painters, painting together. And we were really working during those years together, publishing together at conferences and at other publications, journals, and so on. And together, students with me, student groups, and so on, we have a lot of publications done together. And I think I learn so much, as much as they learn. We learn from each other. And they are so bright, and they come with new ideas, and they are quick, and they are young, full of energy. So it's really very rewarding.
Very good, very good. So you have been in this, you have been teaching, and you have been in academia now for a long time. How has it influenced your own life? Like, what difference has this kind of work had on you as a person?
I think when I was very young, I was thinking about an ideal life in a monastery.
Really?
Yeah.
You wanted to be
I was reading a literature and so.
Okay.
But it's quite close. So somehow you are very much devoted to what you are doing. And it is through many, many, at least in my case, through many, many years, there is a red line from the first models of atomic nuclei in shell model in quantum mechanics until today, when I think about physics, is self-organization and the information processing, everything. So I think it's all somehow connected, and you are always connected with it. So there is no free time, actually. It's always there. And my daughter reminded me the other day, she said, do you remember when I was little that I asked you, Mommy, where are you now? Sometimes I would lose her. I was just thinking, oh, something very important. So my biggest fear was that I would lose this connection with the real world, with my closest ones. So I was always thinking very intensely not to lose it. That was important.
How many children do you have?
I have two. I have Luca, who is 43. He is computer scientist and a big AI enthusiast. And Tia, she is 31, and she is a bioinformatician. And very much interested in helping people, in curing diseases, and so that's her dream. Working for Swedish Health Authority right now, so they in this epidemics and such things.
Mm-hmm. So do you ever find time to relax?
Yes. Nowadays I have three grandchildren. Yes. Yeah. So 1 year, 5 years, and 8 years, and I relax with them, playing with them. It helps me forget everything. So they are totally absorbing me. And I used to have yoga classes, to join yoga classes. Sometimes I was painting. That was a long period in my life. I was painting in oil. And you know, when you paint in oil, it is very slow process, and you must relax and you must focus on it. So I was playing piano some when I was young person. In my youngest years, I was playing piano, and that was also a fantastic way to relax. So it was different periods in my life when I relaxed in different ways. Right now, it's mostly yoga and my grandchildren, playing with them.
So my final question, taking that into consideration and all the work that you have done, what does being human mean to you?
Well, I think being a human is a real privilege. It gave me the possibility to meet people, exciting people, and to connect to people from past, and even think of our common future for the humanity. The feeling is a part of a big humanity. I think there are so many exciting people in the world, and you can read about what they are doing. You can watch their works in art. You can find really amazing human results. And so I think it's so, it feels like a big privilege to be able to connect to the rest of the world as a human. I don't know how it would feel if I would be an elephant, but I think it's good to be human.
You're enjoying being human.
Yeah.
Good. Very good. Well, I enjoyed meeting you. It was a real privilege. Thank you for spending some time with me and our listeners. I think you have given us a lot to think about, and I will promise I will reread your paper and hope to be in contact with you in the future, if I may.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. It was so nice to talk with you and the privilege to be part of this podcast.
Thank you. May I just say that my guest in 2 weeks will be Professor David Peters, Director of the Westminster Center for Resilience, Faculty of Science and Technology, University of Westminster, London. Our subject will be the neurobiology of resistance. Thank you once again, Dr. Dori Krenkovich, and thank you to all the listeners. See you next time. Bye-bye.
See you. Bye.